All right, our second and last case today is number 21-11776, Dante Smith versus the United States. Ms. Salem.
Hi, good morning. May it please the court, my name is Megan Salant, and I represent Mr. Smith in this appeal. Before I get to the merits of our argument, I just want to clarify, there was an editing mistake in my reply brief. In the first full paragraph on page 14, I said that there was no case law from this court regarding the procedural default issue. And clearly that's wrong. That was just a mistake on my part. We recognize Granda and all the cases that came after that, but we do believe that Mr. Smith's case is distinguishable from Granda.
Let's talk about the district court's reasoning. I mean, the district court's reasoning was that, and I'm going to summarize it, at the end of the day, Mr. Smith was convicted under whatever theory of substantive Hobbs Act robbery. And that is a crime of violence under the use of force clause. And that's the end of the matter. What's wrong with that analysis?
Well, I think we can't, there's nothing wrong with that analysis aside from the fact that the jury instructions in this case, they could not have left the jury with a firm belief, or they can't leave the court with a firm belief that there was no error in the jury instructions.
What was the error?
Well, I believe that the jury instructions didn't separate the Hobbs Act robbery from the conspiracy to commit Hobbs Act robbery.
But the Pinkerton instruction said that you could convict one of the defendants of a Hobbs Act robbery if all of the elements of Pinkerton liability were satisfied. What was wrong with that instruction?
Well, the instruction also said that if they found the defendant guilty of conspiracy, they could find him guilty of any of the other offenses, which included the 924C offenses. And just like this court presumes that the jury follows its instructions, it's only logical to assume that they also arrive at their conclusions in the simplest way possible. So once you've told the jury that all they need to do is find the defendant guilty of a conspiracy to commit Hobbs Act robbery, there's no reason to go any further than that. To suspect that then they also examined the individual substantive Hobbs Act robbery in light of the 924C charges.
All right, so can I ask you just a quick question though? Because, I mean, once we're looking at the jury instructions, it seems that the jury instructions also did more than that, right? I mean, there's a separate instruction that seemed to separate out substantive Hobbs Act robbery. If you find the defendant not guilty on any given robbery count, you must also find the same defendant not guilty on any corresponding firearm count.
Sure.
Right? So we can't just take the Pinkerton instruction in isolation. We've got to consider it in the light of that instruction, in the light of the amended indictment, in the light of the verdict form, all of which seem fairly to separate out conspiracy from substantive Hobbs Act robbery.
I think that the jury instructions, they obviously delineate all those different offenses, but the Pinkerton instruction and the conspiracy instruction come directly after the 924C instruction. And I just don't think it's reasonable to expect the jury to make that, to understand that. Again, the jury was told, if you find him guilty of the conspiracy charge, you can find him guilty of any of the other offenses. And it's just not, it doesn't make sense to think that the jury wouldn't hear that and follow that instruction.
So you think respect to what else, what else the jury was instructed, what else it had before it in the form of the amended indictment, what else the verdict form said, that's just sort of like too poisonous, necessarily kind of taints the entire thing.
I think that the confusing instruction on conspiracy liability and Pinkerton liability were enough to negate the earlier instructions. Yes, I believe that the jury would find that very confusing.
How do you get around the historical fact that Mr. Smith was found guilty of the substantive Hobbs Act robbery?
Well, I'm not sure I understand your question. I mean, he was found guilty of the substantive habits of robbery, but
that's a crime of violence.
Sure, but we don't know that that's the crime of violence that the jury relied on in their verdict. We don't know.
But as Judge Newsom said, each 924C count was tied to a specific Hobbs Act robbery, was it not?
It was.
And also,
I had a question for you.
As Judge Newsom was noting, the trial court instructed the jury that in order to convict Smith of any of the 924C counts, it needed to find that he, quote, committed the corresponding robbery offense charged in count 2, 4, 6, or 8. And so that doesn't refer to the conspiracy count. So I guess I'm just not following you on why or how a jury reasonably, given this specific instruction, and we presume that juries follow instructions, could have returned a verdict on the 924, on any 924C count based solely on its decision on conspiracy.
Well, I guess what we would say is that even Mr. Smith's guilt on the substantive Hobbs Act robberies, we don't know if that was based on his actual guilt or on the fact that he was told that if they were found guilty of count one, if he was found guilty of count one, he could also be found guilty of count two or any of the other. I'm just using count two as an example. So if he was found guilty on count two because he was guilty in count one, that means he's really only been found guilty of Hobbs Act robbery, conspiracy to commit Hobbs Act robbery. And that cannot support the subsequent corresponding 924C conviction. The court cannot ignore that the jury was instructed that if they found him guilty of conspiracy, they could also find him guilty of all of the 924C offenses. I don't think that that's, again, you know, I know that we presume that the jury can follow the instructions, but I think these instructions were very confusing. And it ended up it resulted in Mr. Smith spending over 80 more years in prison than he would have without those 924C convictions. And it seems to me that we cannot look at the jury instructions. We have a limited record in this case. We don't have any transcript of the closing arguments. We don't have a transcript of the opening statements. We don't have anything like that to summarize what the theories were from either side. Unlike in some of the other cases post-Granda, where we've been able to look, the court has looked at the weight of the evidence and what the theories of guilt were and the things that were relied upon. In this case, we don't have that. All we have are these really confusing jury instructions.
Why don't we have all those things? Because it's the court reporter's unavailable and no transcript is ever prepared, or what?
They were never prepared. And if you look at the transcript, for instance, there's the trial was in 1999. So, we'll tell you the truth. It wasn't even easy to get the jury instructions in this case. They're not docketed. I mean, they are now because we were able to get them from the archives. But when you look at the transcript in those places where there's supposed to be the opening statements and the closing arguments, it actually cites to a CJA rule and says not prescribed per CJA rule. I can't remember what the exact rule was. But we don't have that wealth of evidence that we had that the court had in the other cases. It just doesn't seem reasonable to me that to risk an exposure of over 80 years based on this, based on a court's willingness to disregard what the jury instruction said.
So, but here's my question, even about the Pinkerton instruction, I am not reading it to say that if you find him guilty of the conspiracy, then you should or could find him, just based on that, guilty of the substantive crimes. Because what the court said was that if he was guilty of conspiracy, count one, with mm-hmm. people who committed the robberies, and these other three conditions existed, his co-conspirator committed the robberies, quote, during the existence of the conspiracy and in furtherance of its objects, unquote. Mm-hmm. Two, that Smith was, quote, a knowing and willful member of the conspiracy at the time of the commission of the robberies, unquote. And three, that the commission of the robberies by a co-conspirator was a reasonably foreseeable consequence of the conspiracy. All of these things would have to be shown anyway to establish liability on the Hobbs Act robbery, the substantive Hobbs Act robbery, would they not?
Yes, but they would be finding, but again, then the defendant would be found guilty based on his.
But why is that so if the district court said specifically that in order to find him guilty of the others, of the robberies themselves, that the jury had to not only find him guilty of conspiracy to commit the robberies, but also of these other three things?
Well, that was how, I'm sorry, I believe the instruction you read was how they would find him guilty of the conspiracy, correct?
So that is under the Pinkerton instruction.
Right. So before he gives those instructions, the judge gives those instructions though, on page 22 of the jury instructions, it says, so in this case, with regards to count 2 through 9, which are the substantive and the 924Cs, if you had first found the defendant guilty of the conspiracy offense as charged in count 1 of the indictment, you may also find him guilty of any offense charged against him in a later count, even though the defendant didn't personally participate in such offense. I think he goes on to give the elements of the Pinkerton instruction, but that in its, like I said, that in and of itself gives the jury permission to only find him, to only find him guilty.
Here's why I don't understand that. Because a theory of substantive liability under a Pinkerton theory mm-hmm. necessarily includes these extra kinds of requirements that conspiracy on a standard, conspiracy for just a standard conspiracy theory that's mm-hmm. not Pinkerton does not include. And that is what differentiates it from the standard conspiracy and also differentiates it from the reasoning in Brown, which is our opinion mm-hmm. that says that, that a conspiracy, a general conspiracy, a usual conspiracy, not a Pinkerton conspiracy, mm-hmm. Cannot fulfill the requirement, under the 924C requirement. You know what I'm saying?
I do. I believe that in theory, what you're saying is correct, but I believe that the jury instructions were so flawed that we can't disregard them here and rely on a non-lawfully educated jury to go back with a fine-tooth comb and figure all that out.
Okay, so just to be clear then, you're not arguing that, you're just arguing that on this specific record, there's a problem, not that Pinkerton liability for a substantive offense can't qualify as a 924C predicate. Is that right?
I believe that that's a different argument for a different day, and it's not the argument in this case, correct?
Okay, I misunderstood, so I thank you for that clarification.
Okay, thank you for the extra time. I'm gonna let Ms. Acosta address the court.
Very much, you've saved all of your time for rebuttal. Ms. Acosta.
Good morning, Your Honors. Winifred Acosta on behalf of the appellee, the United States. Mr. Smith has failed to establish that it was more likely than not that the jury based the guilty verdicts for the 924C solely on the Hobbs Act conspiracy. I want to start with the record. Just looking at the record alone shows that there was no uncertainty, no ambiguity, starting with the indictment. The indictment was redacted to remove any reference to the conspiracy as a predicate for the 924C. Then moving on to the jury's instruction.
What do you mean redacted?
There was a redacted indictment that went back to the jury and it removed the conspiracy as a predicate because the government abandoned that theory at trial.
But you're talking about what went back to the jury, not the way the indictment was phrased.
What went back to the jury, the redacted indictment that went back to the jury.
It was amended, right? Wasn't it amended?
Yes. I just say redacted because that reference was not there. So the jury was not able to read the indictment and see conspiracy as a predicate.
But go back to what Judge Rosenbaum said. Those two things are different. It may not make a difference in this case, but I want to make sure I understand what you're saying. You can have an indictment that is amended, right? Either before trial or sometimes at trial with the consent of the parties in the court because a count may be dropped or something else. Or you can have an indictment that is still the same, but something gets redacted when it gets sent back to the jury because of prejudice concerns, relevance concerns, et cetera. Which one of the two happened here?
It was my understanding that it was redacted, but I think I may be using the terms redacted and amended interchangeably. But the bottom line is understanding.
But here's why it's important, right?
Yes.
I mean, if it was amended, then there's no chance that the jury received an indictment that said that you can convict for 924C based solely on count one, the conspiracy count. If it was redacted and it wasn't amended, you know, then presumably, you know, someone could have argued or the district court at the beginning of the trial or whenever could have read, you know, an indictment that said that you can convict on a 924C count, you know, based on a predicate of conspiracy. And that matters here, right? Or it could matter here. So that's why it's important.
Yes, sure. And I see the difference. And I'm looking back at the indictment, which was part of the record. And the 924Cs only reference substantive robberies.
And is that because the questions that you're being asked, is that because the government sort of renounced any theory that conspiracy could be the hook and amended the indictment to reflect that reality and then redacted whatever old piece of paper there was so that there would be no confusion, that there was a substantive amendment of the indictment?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Right, that's what the district court said. That the indictment as it was drafted provided that I'm looking at page 3 of the district court's order, each 924C count also charged that the count one conspiracy was an underlying crime of violence. Then the district court goes on to explain in the same page that during trial, the government abandoned the part of the indictment predicating the 924C charges on the conspiracy offense. So as the case went to the jury, each 924C count was predicated only on a specific substantive act, Hobbs Act robbery. That's why you say it was a redaction.
Yes, Your Honor, correct. I apologize for the confusion.
It may not be your confusion. It may be a combination of the two things, because if the government is abandoning a legal theory at trial, that may amount to a de facto amending of the indictment with the court's approval and the defendant's consent. And then the indictment gets redacted to conform to that. And we don't have a trial transcript here, so it's sort of hard to figure out exactly how all of that played out.
Yes, Your Honor. And it was my understanding that at the trial, the government did abandon that whole theory of the conspiracy being a predicate for the 924C and solely relied upon the substantive Hobbs Act robberies as predicates for the 924C. And when you look at the jury instructions, there are a couple of places where the 924C is tied directly to a Hobbs Act robbery count. looking at pages 11 and 12 in the introduction of each of the counts. Also, again, on page 17, the 924Cs are again tied directly to the Hobbs Act robbery counts in the discussion of the 924C offenses. And then again, on pages 25 through 26, where the instructions state that if the defendant is found not guilty of a substantive Hobbs Act robbery, the defendant must also be found not guilty of the corresponding 924C. So ultimately, what we have with the jury instructions and the verdict form, the jury was asked to decide whether a firearm was used or brandished in each of the substantive Hobbs Act robberies. And it's as the court has already mentioned, it's well settled that the district court must presume that, must have presumed that the jury followed those instructions. It's unlikely that the jury would have convicted or would have relied only upon the conspiracy of which the object was the commission of four Hobbs Act robberies, when in fact the jury unanimously found the defendant guilty of those four substantive Hobbs Act robberies and unanimously found the defendant or found that a firearm was used or brandished as to each of those Hobbs Act robberies. So our position is that the conspiracy and the substantive robberies were inextricably intertwined, that no reasonable jury would have concluded that the firearms were brandished in furtherance of the conspiracy, but not also the substantive robberies. Those are essentially the same operative facts. And we rely upon Price, which is cited in our brief. The facts are indistinguishable. Like Smith, Price was charged with two 924C offenses that each cited two crimes of violence predicates, bank robbery and conspiracy to commit bank robbery. And the jury instructions removed any reference of the conspiracy as a predicate. And the jury was instructed that they could only convict of each 924C if it found the defendant guilty of the corresponding bank robbery. So the jury instructions in the Price case made it clear that the convictions were based on a valid predicate. Here, the same thing. The jury instructions and the verdict form made it clear that that's what the jury did. They based their guilty verdicts on a valid predicate, that being the four substantive Hobbs Act robberies. And even in Price, the court said that the jury instructions essentially untied the 924C from the conspiracy. And in this case, on these facts, on this record, we argue that the jury instructions and the verdict form basically tied the 924C to the Hobbs Act robbery, the substantive counts, and untied the 924C from the conspiracy.
So can I ask you a quick question about Price? And I'm sorry that I've just forgotten sort of the specific details of Price. But so Price, you say, was like this case in the sense that it involved a substantive count and the conspiracy to achieve that same substantive count. So, but because I guess I would have thought that at least like say Hobbs Act robbery and conspiracy to commit Hobbs Act robbery, they're obviously related, but they're not inextricably intertwined factually necessarily. I mean, the conspiracy might precede or post-date the commission of the crime itself. Am I wrong about that? I mean, and maybe Price answers the question, but I mean, seems a little different from where you've got like, say, two crimes that are necessarily inextricably intertwined factually, so that if the, you know, sort of if the jury found one, it necessarily found the other. That doesn't seem like true, like logically to me with respect to substantive Hobbs Act robbery and conspiracy to commit Hobbs Act robbery. Those two things could be sort of like temporally and factually distinct, although related.
That's true. But I think if you look at the operative facts, the message that I'm trying to convey here is that it's not reasonable for a jury to have found that a firearm was used or brandished with respect to the conspiracy, but not on the other hand, find that it was used or brandished with respect to a substantive robbery, when in fact you really do have an overlap of the facts. They were inextricably intertwined. The operative facts a lot were the same. So that's where we get the overlapping from, if that makes sense to the court.
Can I ask you one further, just sort of like potential hang up that I have? And it pertains to the language of 924C. The clause here that we're dealing with that says that the defendant must what use or carry the firearm during and in relation to a crime of violence. And we know here the only valid crime of violence, everybody agrees, the only valid crime of violence is Hobbs Act robbery. But by virtue of the Pinkerton instruction, I mean, Pinkerton, and I'm oversimplifying here a little bit, but Pinkerton basically makes the defendant vicariously liable for the crimes of his co-conspirators, right? And so if by virtue of Pinkerton, we can't even be certain that this defendant himself committed Hobbs Act robbery, he might be liable for Hobbs Act robbery by virtue of something that John Doe did. How can we be sure that he used or carried this firearm both during Hobbs Act robbery and in relation to Hobbs Act robbery? I would think he certainly carried it in relation to Hobbs Act robbery, even on a conspiracy theory, even on a Pinkerton theory. But can we be sure that he used or carried during Hobbs Act robbery? Or does Pinkerton basically just say like, yeah, look, he's covered under the during piece of this conjunction as well, by virtue of his vicarious liability for the crime of his buddy?
That's an interesting question, Your Honor. And I think that the during is covered by the vicarious liability, because when you think about it, the Pinkerton liability, it doesn't change the nature of the offense. The elements remain the same. So the Pinkerton liability doesn't convert a substantive offense into a conspiracy. It really doesn't. The actual or threatened use of force or the fear of injury is still an element, regardless of who actually committed that act, whether or not it is the defendant or it's a co-conspirator. The bottom line is that the elements remain the same, and there still is that element, actual or threatened use of force, which I think is very important.
Yeah, just so I understand. So the government's position is that this defendant could be guilty of carrying a firearm during a Hobbs Act robbery, even if the only hook for his liability, conviction for Hobbs Act robbery, is the act committed by someone else, by virtue of Pinkerton.
As long as all of the elements of the Pinkerton liability are satisfied, then yes, again, because the elements haven't changed, the nature of the offense, the nature hasn't changed.
To follow up on Judge Newsom's question, your answer, I think, would remain the same, even though potentially, as Ms. Salent argued, both convictions, the Hobbs Act robbery conviction and the Tide 924C conviction, were both premised on Pinkerton liability.
There's nothing in the record to say that.
Let's talk about this hypothetical. So let's assume that Mr. Smith is convicted of one of the Hobbs Act robberies solely based on Pinkerton liability. He was sick that day. He wasn't there, but he knew that his co-conspirators were going to do it, and they were able to do it without him that day. So he did not participate that day, right? So his conviction, let's assume the evidence is sufficient. He gets convicted of that Hobbs Act robbery in which he did not personally participate. based on a Pinkerton theory. You're with me so far?
I am.
For that same robbery, he never carried a gun during and or in relation to a crime of violence because he wasn't there. He gets convicted of the 924C count tied to that robbery, again, because of Pinkerton liability, because one of his co-conspirators possessed a gun during that robbery. You're saying that that 924C enhancement is perfectly appropriate?
As long as all of the elements for Pinkerton liability are satisfied, as long as there's this is a foreseeable consequence of his engagement in the conspiracy, just like with the aiding and abetting in Cologne, it found, the aider and the abettor is treated or is responsible just as a principal is. So necessarily, the aider and abettor is considered to have satisfied the elements of the offense just as a principal would.
Okay, Ms. Acosta, thank you very much. We appreciate it. Okay, you've got your full time for rebuttal.
Thank you. The first thing, I just want to go back to what the court was asking Ms. Acosta at the beginning of her presentation. I think that I actually had the same confusion with my client about the redaction and the amendment. I do believe that it was amended, and the government did in fact denounce their reliance on the conspiracy chart or the conspiracy for the Hobbs Act robbery. I'm sorry, for the 924C offenses. If the court wants, I can supplement the record with the trial transcript where that happens. It was on the second day of trial. But I agree with what Ms. Acosta was saying. It wasn't redacted. It was amended. I mean, the way we're now using those phrases, it was in fact amended.
That would be helpful. If you could do that within the next week, please.
Absolutely.
Just confer with Ms. Acosta, make sure you both agree that that's the relevant portion of the transcript, and then you can just submit it.
Yes, absolutely. I'd be happy to do that. I'd also like to talk about, to go back to Judge Jordan's hypothesis about Mr. Smith not being there and being convicted based on Pinkerton liability for the substantive and then also for the 924C. I think that that's exactly the problem, is that the way that the jury instructions were structured, we are all sitting here discussing, how the liability could be, different ways that he could be found liable for different offenses and what's valid and what's not. But the bottom line is the jury was told if he was convicted of the conspiracy, he could be convicted of anything else. So we don't know what the jury thought about counts 2 through 9, whether they were based on their own individual assessments of those, or if they saw the easiest path to find the conviction, or to not necessarily the easiest path, not to make it seem like they didn't want to do their jobs, but they found the simplest path, the one, well, therefore, if one, then therefore 2 through 9.
And if you were dealing only with that Pinkerton instruction, I think your argument would be stronger, but you've got all the other instructions which tie each 924C count to the prerequisite of a corresponding Hobbs Act robbery conviction.
Sure, I understand that. We recognize that the instructions that were given were, when you go to the jury instruction builder, I mean, they were the proper instructions. They just weren't structured in a way that I believe that the jury, not only that the jury could follow them in the appropriate manner, but that this court can now, years, over 22 years later, can say with certainty that it has no doubt that flawed structure in the instructions didn't lead to a invalid verdict on the jury's part. And I also, the Brecht standard requires that there needs to be a more than reasonable possibility that there was actual prejudice. And I think these instructions in human nature dictate just that. If there are no other questions, then Mr. Smith would ask that you reverse the ruling on his 2255 motion and remand to the district court. Thank you.
All right, thank you both very much. So if you could file that portion of the transcript by next Friday.
Absolutely.
That would be very helpful. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
All right. That constitutes our panel for the week, and we are in recess.